We come to the 33rd study for the week, 7:30 Friday evening, the Arkansas Camp 1982, and this is the 1st of October, is it not? Time surely marches on. We now go back to the 10th chapter of Revelation. As I said, this is a very fruitful chapter for study, bringing to view, as it does, the opening of the great Second Advent movement in 1833, and on through 1844, the great disappointment, and beyond that into the harvest field of the entire world. We'll look one more time now at the second verse of Revelation 10. And he had in his hand a little book open, and he set his right foot upon the sea and his left foot upon the earth. In the Bible commentary, as we read before, we are told that the setting of the right foot upon the earth and the left foot upon the sea, the other way about actually, the right foot upon the sea and the left foot upon the earth, is an indication of the vast extent of the work which is brought to view by this revelation of Jesus Christ at this point. I'll read now from page 971 in the Bible Commentary, Volume 7. Setting his right foot on the sea and his left upon the dry land shows the part which he is acting in the closing scenes of the great controversy with Satan. This position denotes his supreme power and authority over the whole earth. We who do have a strong Seventh-day Adventist background have become used to the expression, the world is our field. We think in terms of nothing short of a global effort. I remember very well how, when I was back in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the leaders stressed again and again that the message must go to every nation, kindred, tongue and people, and so it surely must. And I recall somewhere in the early 50s when at long last the Review and Herald proclaimed that the last country upon the face of the earth had been entered, and Seventh-day Adventists were actually in every single country upon the face of the earth. And I remember at the time thinking what a magnificent achievement this was, and being assured in my heart that this was a sign that the end must follow very, very quickly. However, we find instead that there came the fearful wars that followed, the great uprisings of the communist world, especially in the land of China, and some of those lands where Seventh-day Adventism had been established expelled the Adventist people completely from their midst. As far as we know, in some of those countries, the Advent faith seems to have died away completely. So some ground, of course, has again been lost in that respect. I've heard two Adventist evangelists talking in terms of how speedily the message could be carried to every nation, kindred, tongue and people if one person told somebody else, and they told somebody else, and so on across the world. But I realise today, of course, that the Adventism, which was being spoken about by this kind of program, could certainly never finish the work. And if every person upon the face of the earth, with no exception, was to become a Seventh-day Adventist after the Laodicean or the Evangelical Order, we still would not see the work finished, would we? Because it is by the gospel of Jesus Christ that this great work must be done. And it suddenly has been impressed upon my mind that this idea of worldwide evangelism is something which is to a certain extent singular, and rightly so, to these last days of human history. Because when we go back to earlier ages, we tend to find that the Church of God was restricted to a very small geographical area. Let's think of the days of Abraham, for instance, who was very much the faithful servant of God, and the one who raised the altar of sacrifice every night and every morning, the one who was a very effective evangelist, and who was successful in winning quite a number of souls to the gospel of Jesus Christ. But how wide was his mission field? Pardon? It wasn't all the world. It was limited to a little country called what we now call Palestine, or what was in those days called Canaan. Then, when there came upon the scene Isaac and Jacob and his 12 sons, we find that one of those sons goes down to Egypt, not according to his will, of course, but according to the circumstances which were raised at that time. And we're told in the Bible commentary that Joseph was God's missionary to the land of Egypt. When missionaries today, of course, embark on international missions, in other words, they go out, supposing a missionary is sent to Brazil, to Peru, to Argentina, or maybe the islands of the Pacific, as the case may be, they go on their way knowing perfectly well they have been sent with a specific purpose of being missionaries. But when Joseph went down to Egypt, did he have any idea at all that he was going there as a missionary? None at all. But that's how he went. I'd like to read now some thoughts from the Bible Commentary Volume 1 again, where we're plainly told that the Volume 1, page 1098, and the statement says, it's taken from the Youth's Instructor, April 15, 1897, "The sin of the Egyptians was that they had refused the light which God had so graciously sent to them through Joseph." So God sent great light through Joseph to the Egyptians when he was sold as a slave in the Potiphar's house, and when later he was imprisoned, and when later still he became the second in command of the entire nation, which at that time was the greatest, most powerful and most influential nation upon the face of the earth. Possessed the highest culture, the greatest learning, the greatest buildings, the greatest army, and the greatest corruption too. Now naturally, of course, when Joseph's mission began in the house of Potiphar, he had a very limited missionary field. But as his position enlarged and increased, he finally, of course, had a very extensive missionary field. And the sin of the Egyptians was that they refused the light which God had sent to them through Joseph. Now for the next 400 years or thereabouts, we find that the Israelites remain in slavery, but they finally were taken out of slavery and placed in the school of the wilderness. Now certainly the wilderness was not a base for evangelism. That's very, very clear. And but rather that was the place where God took them for schooling in preparation for their entrance into the promised land, where under God's direction they built a beautiful temple. It didn't come for a long, long time, but that was much later than God planned it should be. And it was God's intention that Israel should make Palestine to be the missionary center of the world. But did they? No, they didn't. Instead, Palestine became the commercial center of the world. And I want you now to think of the limited extent of the gospel outreach during the days of ancient Israel, a time when the true believers were to be found practically exclusively within the borders of Canaan, although, mark you well, of course, that while in general terms Israel became the commercial capital of the world, at the same time there were true people who did spread the light, just a few individuals here and there, and some of those merchants passing through north-south and south-to-north no doubt took the message back to their own lands again. Then came, of course, the Babylonian captivity, beyond that the restoration, and not until we come down to the days of the apostles does the message begin to assume worldwide proportions, but even then a very limited world. I understand the gospel penetrated as far east as India under, I think, Philip's ministry, or was it, yeah, Philip's ministry. It went somewhat north into the northern European lands. It progressed west as far as England and Ireland. It never crossed the Atlantic as far as we know at that time, and did enter to a certain extent in North Africa. Of course, the gigantic Sahara Desert was an obstacle to progress south into the tropical lands of what we now call the Congo and those areas. Now, with the failure of the Apostolic Church and the rise of the papacy, we find that the believers during the Middle Ages could not think so much in terms of worldwide evangelism as they had to think in terms of just simply hanging on, especially during the Waldensian period. But as the gospel began to gain in power, the missionary concept began to also enlarge very strongly. And William Carey, as you remember, was the man who gained the vision of going to India and went to India, despite, of course, the wise discouragement, or the so-called wise discouragement, of the leaders of the Anglican Church. As you may remember, of course, Carey stood up in the business meeting or in the church meeting and talked about his dream of going to India, and one of the aged leaders said to him, "Sit down, young man, When God wants to convert the Indians, he'll do without your help of mine. Kelly went anyway and established the great missionary outpost in India. By the time we come to the Wesleyans, we find that missionary journeys were being conducted into America, this country of course, and into other parts of the world. But the real outburst of world evangelism sprang into being when we come down to the actual time of the end. And today, that's the only thing we think in terms of, and that is of world evangelism. Remember the words of Jesus Christ in Matthew 24, where he said, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come." And just before Christ went to heaven, he said to his followers, "And to you and to me, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel." And when we come down to the angels of Revelation chapter 14 and 18, let's read that well-known verse in Revelation 14 verse 6. "And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell upon the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people." In Revelation chapter 18 verse 1, "And after these things I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory." So, in these last days, God thinks in terms of nothing short of world evangelism with such effectiveness that every man and woman and child in the biggest cities, in the deepest jungles, in the frozen regions of the north, in every single part of the world, every Arab, every Islamic, every communist, every Roman Catholic, every Protestant, every Adventist, every heathen, every person will hear the gospel of salvation and will either accept it or reject it. So there will be only two classes of people, those who have the seal of God and those who have the mark of the beast in the end. Now, Revelation 10 is a chapter which confirms the opening days of this unrestricted evangelism clear around the world. This is why in the second verse you find that Jesus Christ is pictured as having his right foot upon the sea and his left foot upon the earth, to indicate not only his dominion over the entire world, but the fact that his voice will be heard throughout the entire world, with no one failing to hear his voice speaking to them personally. Let's now turn to verse 6 to find further confirmation of this, which says, "And swear by him that liveth for ever and ever, who created heaven and the things that therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer." Now, what is the master reading to these three words, time no longer? No more delay. Delays are over and finished with. Now, if there's to be no more delay, then what obviously must there have been? Delays in the previous period of time. And I think I mentioned earlier in the week, of course, the question and answer formed in Daniel the 8th chapter. I hope you have that clear in mind at the present point of time, because the tragic picture of history from the way, way back there in the beginning of time is the world that work could have been finished back in Joshua's day, and it wasn't, and could later have been finished in David's day, but wasn't, and again during the 490 years, but again it didn't. The Apostolic Church had the opportunity, and the Seventh-day Adventist Church likewise had the opportunity, but in each of these cases there has been this delay because people have turned from doing God's work, God's way, to doing God's work, man's way. And every time that has brought a sad delay to the cause of God. Perhaps we'll just spend a moment refreshing our minds from Daniel the 12th chapter. I will take it as read that you understand Daniel chapter 8 verses 13 and 14 in the light of that question and answer. We dealt with it earlier in the week, so I don't want to be too repetitious. But let's look at Daniel the 12th chapter, which will help us to catch something of the same view that we find being confirmed in Revelation chapter 10. And it is necessary to understand Daniel chapter 12 in order to really appreciate Revelation chapter 10. We come down to verse 5, and this is strictly where the 12th chapter of Revelation should begin, because the first four verses are the ending of the message of chapter 11. "Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two, the one on this side of the bank of the river, and the other on that side of the bank of the river. And one said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? There's a question. And what do questions require? Answers. And in verse 7 the answer is given. And I heard the man clothed in linen which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth for ever, that shall be for time, times and a half, and when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. Now what shall be finished? These things. Now what are these things? Right, these wonders. Now without losing your place in Daniel chapter 12, let's go back to Revelation 10 for a moment. We find a very striking comparison between these two verses. Revelation 10 verse 6 says, and swear, well first of all verse 5, and the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven. Now what did the heavenly messenger do back in Daniel chapter 12 verse 7? He lifted up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven. Now of course the angel in Revelation 10 didn't lift up both hands because one hand was busy holding a book. But in Daniel 10, both hands are held up Daniel 12, both hands are held up. In Revelation 10, one hand was held up. Now then, let's come back to Revelation 10 again. And it says, and he swear by him, where am I again now? Verse 6, and swear by him that liveth forever and ever, who created heaven and the things which therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things which are therein. Now let's come back to Daniel chapter 12. And here we find that we have pretty much the same thing. It says, and swear by him that liveth forever. There shall be for a time, times and a half, and so on. So we find now a very striking similarity in the solemnity and the positiveness and the authority with which God conveys this message, first of all to Daniel and secondly to Revelation. In other words, God is saying, by the utmost authority of my word I am telling you, it shall be so. Now how long to the end of these wonders? Time, times and half a time. And we know by comparing Revelation 12, 6 with Revelation 12, 13 and 14, that time, times and half a time are 1,260 years. And back in Daniel chapter 7, we're plainly told there that the 1260 years were to be from the rise to the fall of the papal power, which was from 538 to 1798. In other words, when we're told in Daniel chapter 7 that the time, times, and dividing of time are from 538 to 1798, then when we again read about time, times, and half a time in Daniel chapter 12, what are we to know? The same thing. Having been told it previously, then when you encounter that same thing again, you're expected to understand it. Now some people, to my immense surprise and amazement, start thinking of relocating the 1260 days of Daniel chapter 12 in a different place from the 1260 days of Daniel chapter 7. You can't do that. That's inconsistent. Now, when Daniel heard this question, or this answer, I should say, to the question, he very frankly said in verse 8, and I heard, but I understood not. Then said I, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? Now back in verse 6, the question was, what shall be the end of these wonders? At the end of verse 7 it says, all these things shall be finished. And now the question is repeated, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? Now are these things and these wonders all the same thing? Are they? No, certainly. Because we have one subject on Daniel's mind, and that subject is the question, how long shall be the end of these wonders? And the answer was to that very question when the words were said, and time, times and half a time, and then all these things shall be finished. And Daniel said, well, I heard it, but I didn't understand it, so I asked the question again, what shall be the end of these things? There's no shift at all in the subject. Those wonders are those things very plainly and clearly. And once again, God gives the answer. Verse 9, 10, and 11 makes it all very clear. And he said, "Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed and up and sealed till the time of the end," which began, of course, in 1798. "Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." And now comes the more specific answer, which says, "And from the time that the daily shall be taken away, and the abomination maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1290 days." Now, if we go back to Daniel chapter 11, we have confirmation, of course, that the daily was taken away and the abomination was set up about 1290 years before 1798. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 11 and confirm this very, very simple fact. Daniel chapter 11, verses 1 to 4, deal with the great battles between Grecia and Medo-Persia, which broke the Medo-Persian power and established Grecia as the world's great empire. Verses 5 on down through about verse 15 or so talks about subsequent battle between the king of the north and the king of the south. And then verse 15 or 16 or thereabouts down to verse 29 talk about the supremacy of the pagan Roman Empire. Verse 30 brings us to the ships of Chittim, which were, of course, the invasions of those barbarian kings we read about just a day or so ago when looking at the seven trumpets that brought judgments against pagan and then papal Rome. But this, of course, was pagan Rome, the ships of Chittim. And that brings us down, of course, to about 476 AD. It brings us down to those days just before the supremacy of the papacy was established. In verse 31, right in that time slot, around about 500 AD, the word of God plainly said, "And arms shall stand in his path, and they shall pollute the sanctuary strength, and shall take away the daily, and shall place the abomination and make it desolate." And from that time to the end of these wonders was 1290 years. Right? So we come back now to around about this time, around about 500, it was actually, of course, the year 508. The 1290 days bring us down again to 1798, which marked the end of these wonders. And that, I think, should be very, very plain and clear, because Daniel chapter 11 plainly establishes that the daily was taken away and the abomination of desolation set up around about 500 AD, before the papacy came to power, but after the arrival of the ten kings who had broken up the Roman Empire by 476 AD. So here now we have 476 AD, and by that time we have the ten kings, which are here called the ships of Chittim. So that confirms in very clear terms the fact that the end of these things was 1798. Very good. Now finally, of course, in verse 12, there comes the statement, "Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1335 days." And that obviously, of course, this 1335 days is spoken of in connection with the 1290 days. They have the same starting point and bring us down to 1843. And blessed indeed were those who came to that point of time, because they stood upon the borders of the most tremendous events of human history. The close of the 2300 days, the transfer of Christ to the most holy place, and the work thereafter of building the great Second Advent movement, carrying the gospel to all the world and seeing Jesus Christ come again in the clouds of heaven. Now, having established the fact that these wonders came to their end in 1798, rather, we now have to ask ourselves the question, what are these wonders? And to find the answer, we only have to cast our minds back over the contents of Daniel 11, Daniel 9, Daniel 8, Daniel 7, and Daniel 2, but particularly Daniel 8 and Daniel chapter 11. Because in those two chapters we find portrayed for us the struggles between the Church of God and the man of sin, or the synagogue of Satan, and throughout that period of time, covered by Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11 in particular, who emerges as the almost continually ascendant or triumphant power during that long period of the Dark Ages. Church of God, the papacy, right? And when we cast our mind back beyond the days of Jesus Christ, through the rise of Rome and the before that Medo-Persia, Grecia rather, before that Medo-Persia, before this Babylon, let's go right back to Solomon's day, to Joshua's day, and all the way down through all this history, who do we find to be the ascendant power in the struggles between the Church of God and the man of sin most of the time? The Church of God? No, Babylon. Now, that history is spoken of as being a source of wonder. In other words, all these events are called wonders, or sources of amazement, sources of surprise, the subject of almost unbelief that things could go the way they did. And is it not a remarkable wonder that the people of God, who have the equipment of God and the power of God and the leadership of God and the truth of God, could find themselves suffering at the hands of the enemy so consistently and so continuously as they did down through all those ages? Isn't that a wonder? What should the picture have been? The opposite. Nothing but victory, 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 victory. Now, I think we must acknowledge the fact tonight that we came in the Adventist Church's experience at least, and we still, I think, have a certain residue of this. We tend to think failure. Now, we tend to expect things to fail. We don't expect to find the great and mighty works of God being manifest amongst us. When we get sick, we don't really expect to be healed. When we have sin, we don't really expect to be victorious. Until, of course, under certain situations, our faith does grasp the promises of God, and we do experience some victory. But because we have this failure complex, once we have gained some victory, we still worry about where we can maintain these things as far as the future is concerned. But now, back in Daniel's day, God, looking down through history, raised the question to Daniel, and the question was, what shall be the end of these wonders? When will there come a transition point, a cutting off, a time of change, when these wonders shall then be a thing of the past, the end of them, mark you carefully, and from that point on, a new era, a new day, a new way altogether for the Church of God? And the answer was, at the end of... Is there any... Oh, here you are. I can't even feel him. There it is. Thank you very much. Nice little diversion. Now, the point I was making is this, that... I guess I lost it now, thanks to the moth. The point I was making is that 1798 then marks the end of these wonders and the beginning of a new era. Now, in Revelation 10, we find that this point of time does not go by unnoticed. That no less a personage than Jesus Christ, for the first time in the book of Revelation, and in fact in the book of Daniel too for that matter, that Jesus Christ is pictured as coming all the way down from heaven to this earth to place his, let me get this straight now, I get this left and right foot mixed up every time. I think it's his right foot upon the earth, on the sea, is it? Thank you. His left foot upon the earth. Right, verse 2, his right foot upon the sea and his left foot upon the earth. Now, this is the first time in the book of Revelation that we find Jesus Christ pictured as coming all the way down from heaven to take up this extraordinary position down here upon this earth. Now, let's go back and just review the various revelations of Jesus Christ in the book of Revelation. For instance, we find, do we not, in Revelation chapter 1, that he's there pictured as walking up and down in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks, which basically is a position up in the courts of heaven above, namely in the first apartment of the heavenly sanctuary. In Revelation 4 and 5, where do we find Jesus Christ? Again, before God's throne, in the holy place of the heavenly sanctuary, a lamb as it had been slain, who takes the book and opens the seven seals thereof. In Revelation chapter 8, and you should remember this one for certain, that's the chapter which opens the seven seals, where do we find Jesus Christ? At the altar. as the great intercessor, the great mediator, standing at the altar of incense, right in the presence of God, receiving our prayers, mingling them with the incense of his righteousness, and sending up those prayers and all their power, all his power and glory to the Heavenly Father. So every picture of Christ up until this point is a picture of him where? Up in heaven. But now we find that there's a picture of him having come down from heaven to destroy this earth with his power and presence, and to make the solemn announcement in harmony with the prophecy given to Daniel back in the past, that when we come to 1844, because we come to the end of these wonders, there shall be no more delay. Isn't that a wonderful confirmation? A tremendous encouragement? And that means, of course, that God's people have to get out of the defeat attitude, the defeat mentality, and think only of victory, victory, victory all the way. Because this is the hour, this is the time of the end when the work of God can be finished. Let's now look again at Revelation 10 and verse 7. We find this thought now is still further confirmed. After having said there should be delay, no more delay or time no longer, it says, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished as he hath declared to his servants the prophets. Now, what is the mystery of God? Very good. It is Christ in you, the hope of glory. And many of you, of course, have seen the study which we entitled, The 2 Days of Opportunity, developed, of course, from the relationship of Daniel 9 and Daniel 8, or the unexplained portion of Daniel 8 and its explanation in Daniel chapter 9. And we saw there how that to the Jewish people in 457 B.C. was given a marvelous day of opportunity during the succeeding 490 years in which to make an end of sin and to finish transgression and to bring in everlasting righteousness. And in the little book, Consecrated Way to Christian Perfection, A.T. Jones makes a very strong point, and a very valid point, that the finishing of the mystery of God and the making of an end of sins and bringing of everlasting righteousness is the same work. Because what is the mystery of God? As we said a moment ago, it is Christ in you, the hope of glory. It is the marriage of divinity with humanity. It is the perfect union of these two lives. But what is it that separates humanity from divinity, if there is a separation? Sin. As God said back in Isaiah, your sins have separated between you and your God, so that he will not hear you. Now, when then the Jews were given the opportunity of making an end of sin and the bringing of everlasting righteousness, then was that not the promise to them that the mystery of God in them should be finished? Absolutely. And when, in turn, in Revelation chapter 10, the Lord God of heaven talks in terms of the mystery of God being finished, he is simply saying the time has come when sin shall be ended and everlasting righteousness brought in. So whichever way you read it, it means the same thing whether it's back in Daniel or here in the book of Revelation. So as I read the book of Revelation chapter 10 tonight, I am deeply impressed with the fact that this is the picture of Jesus Christ coming down to confirm the words given to Daniel way back in his day, that by 1798, the end of the 1260 years, these wonders should be finished, and so Jesus Christ, there will be no more delaying, there should be time no longer, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished. And of course, you appreciate the fact we have not yet played the seventh trumpet, have we? We stayed the first six, briefly stayed them. But the seventh trumpet does not appear until the end of chapter 11. I don't think we'll get that far. I know we won't get that far during this camp meeting. That'll be picked up in the Australian camp meeting. And if you want to hear that part, you'll have to get the tapes from down there. And they won't be ready, of course, until next January when the camp meeting is ended. Now, I'd like to spend a few moments down there, closing 6 minutes, looking at some of the great assurances God gives to us in his word, that the only intended pathway or privilege of Christians is a life of victory. Let's turn to the Desire of Ages, page 490, first of all, and this is one of my favorite statements in this particular connection. page 490, where we read words which are, for the unbeliever, absolutely too good to be true. Page 490, the scenes of the past and the future were presented to the mind of Jesus. Now this is when the 70 apostles had come back from their missionary journey and said to Jesus Christ, Lord, even the devils are subject unto us through thy name. Jesus answered, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. The scenes of the past and the future were presented to the mind of Jesus. He beheld Lucifer as he was first cast out from the heavenly places. He looked forward to the scenes of his own agony, when before all the world the character of the deceiver would be unveiled. He heard the cry, It is finished, announcing that the redemption of the lost race was forever made certain, that heaven was made eternally secure against the accusations, the deceptions, the pretensions that Satan would inspire, or would instigate. Beyond the cross of Calvary, with its agony and shame, Jesus looked forward to the great final day when the prince of the power of the air will meet his destruction on the earth so long marred by his rebellion. Jesus beheld the work of evil forever ended and the peace of God filling heaven and earth. Now, before I read any further, what kind of thinking was passing through the mind of Jesus Christ at this point of time? The idea or the mentality of defeat or the inspiration of victory? Absolute victory. Now, there's a transfer now in the thought from the thinking of the mind of Jesus Christ to the thinking of those who follow Jesus Christ. And just as Jesus Christ thinks victory and nothing but victory, so we likewise are thinking the same terms. Henceforward, Christ's followers will look upon Satan as a conquered foe. In other words, we are not to look upon Satan as a foe to be conquered, but as a conquered foe. Now, it greatly grieves me when I hear people say, well, I didn't get to camp this year because Satan is so strong, he just stopped me from coming. That doesn't sound like a conquered foe to me. And they might say to me, well, the devil's been very busy lately. He's caused me this trouble, and he stopped me doing this, and he stopped me doing the other thing. That doesn't sound to me like a conquered foe, does it? Now, if Satan gets the better of us, it is only because we have failed to look upon him in the right light. And we do well to forget all about the devil. After all, he's beaten. And why worry about a conquered foe or someone beaten? Let's think in terms of the matchless power of Jesus Christ. Let's understand this, that no Christian ever goes out to get the victory over sin or Satan or the world. No Christian does that. No true child of God ever does that. What the true child of God does is to get the victory. Then he goes out with the victory. Let's read this thought now in the same paragraph. Upon the cross, Jesus was to gain the victory for them, that victory he desired them to accept as their own. Note those words. Jesus gained the victory, and he desires us to accept this victory as his own. We don't have to just simply follow his example and grab and get our own victory. He got the victory. He defeated Satan. And now he gives to us the victory which he personally gained for us upon Calvary's cross. And I know that if we in these last days will grasp that wonderful principle, if first of all we shall realize that we are living in the hour of victory, at the end of these wonders, and those wonders mean defeat for God's people, so if those wonders which mean defeat for God's folk are over, then what is the cry or the watchword of this hour? Victory. Victory in Jesus, victory right through to the finished work. Now when we realize Satan is a conquered foe, when we know that we're living in the last closing days of this earth's history, when God is recruiting an army and preparing this army for the last great conflict, when we know that we have received the almighty equipment of God's truth, of God's spirit, of God's leadership and protection, that Satan is a conquered foe, then we can devote ourselves to appropriating all the provisions of God. We can grow in grace and become strong and true and trustworthy. And then as we turn our minds away from Satan's miserable power, as we remember that he is a conquered foe, then God can very, very speedily equip us for the final battle and we shall see a new wonder and a new marvel which we shall call the church triumphant, the church which, through which God will finish his work and hasten that glorious day of his soon return. We are a people of great privilege and tremendous opportunity. And before us, while the battle shall be grim, before us is the prospect of actually seeing Jesus Christ coming in the clouds of heaven without our having tasted of death in the meantime. And that is the privilege, of course, to which the saints and prophets of all ages look forward with longing desire.